Now, here to present a special edition this week of Focus on Faith is Rosemary Harthill.
Hello, and a very warm welcome to this special edition of Focus on Faith. I'm at a celebration party at the British Library. The guests include representatives of Armenian communities around the world, including the United States, France, the Holy Land, and of course, Armenia itself. Among the guests is His Holiness Karakhin II, Supreme Patriarch and Catholicos of the Armenian people. Joining the British Foreign Secretary and others, he's come to launch the first major exhibition in Britain of Armenian art. It marks the 1700th anniversary of the declaration of Christianity as the state religion of Armenia, the very first country in the world to adopt Christianity officially. A mere 70 years ago, the future of the church in that small Caucasian country of high plateaus and mountains was seriously in doubt. The theology of the national church in many ways resembles that of the Eastern Orthodox. Under Stalin, Christianity in the Soviet Republic of Armenia was systematically repressed. Today, in the 10th year of independent Armenia, the national church is freer than for centuries. But how is it meeting the challenges of the modern world? Can it break away from its old Soviet-era image as little more than a fossilized museum? And how, if at all, can it help forge better relations with modern Russians and Turks, whose ancestors' conflicts with Armenians last century resulted in so much suffering? These are some of the questions we'll be exploring in this program with our guests, including the curator of this special British Library exhibition, Dr. Vrej Nersesyan. So let's glimpse this treasure house of art and culture inspired by a faith that stretches back to the biblical figure of Noah. After the flood, it was within the ancient realm of Armenia that his ark came to rest.
And God remembered Noah and every living thing and all the cattle that was with him in the ark. And God made a wind to pass over the earth, and the waters assuaged. And the ark rested in the seventh month, on the 17th day of the month, upon the mountains of Ararat.
Dr. Nersesyan, we're standing now at the very opening of the exhibition, and there's a marvellous picture of Mount Ararat, covered in snow, beforehand a rather bare landscape, and two churches. What does it represent?
These two, Mount Ararat and Noah's Ark, symbolize the Armenian Christian faith.
And this is why you've called the exhibition, yes, Presumably Treasures of the Ark.
Treasures of the Ark, for two reasons, not only for the symbolic value, but also because I think the Ark represents two concepts, one of survival and the second of creativity.
Well, let's now go into the exhibition and have a look at one of the tapestries over here, which gives a sense of incredibly long history of Christianity in Armenia.
We are standing in front of a large altar curtain. It actually tells the story of the conversion of Armenia to Christianity in 301, when St. Gregory the Illuminator converted King Terdad and the Armenian population to Christianity.
It's an absolutely beautiful altar curtain, about 2.5 meters by 3.5 meters. The most striking character is St. Gregory here in the middle, I think. And before him, the king and his court are kneeling. There is a river by the side in which Armenians are being baptized. There's a sense of churches being built. But around the edge, a border of terrible things happening.
Yes, the artist refers back to the pre-Christian period, when St. Gregory was tortured by the same king for 15 years.
Well, let's just have a look at one of these. St. Gregory seems to be sitting before the king with his hands tied, and he has a bag over his head. What's going on here? Yes.
According to the inscription, the large sack filled with cinders from a furnace was fixed over his head, and the mouth of the sack tied around his neck.
But despite all this, he won through and converted the king.
That's right. Let me show you now two illuminated pages, one showing the Annunciation of the Virgin Mary and the visit of the Magi The Illuminated Pages picture the state of illumination before the Arab invasion, 640. This Illuminated Pages predates the Kells Gospel and many of the Western traditions.
Now, just over here is some of the text of those Gospels, which is in a script which is completely different from any script I've ever seen in my life. This is unique to Armenian writing, is it?
Yes. In 406, a very conscious decision was taken to create an Armenian alphabet. The first book that was translated into Armenian was the Bible. And the marriage of the faith with the language becomes the main survival motive of the Armenian nation. That alphabet created in the 6th century is still serving the Armenian nation unchanged.
Ever since those early beginnings of Christianity in Armenia, two things have helped unite its people: their shared faith and shared bouts of suffering.
I cannot forget that. I will never forget, because it wasn't a fight that you're fighting for war. It's just cutting up a nation into pieces, children into pieces, girls into pieces, grabbing them, grabbing them, killing them for nothing.
This is Agavni Gulasarian, one of the last survivors of a massacre of Armenians in 1915, a memory that still haunts Armenians today. Hundreds of years before her birth, Armenia was a large independent kingdom stretching over land now within the borders of Turkey, Iran, Iraq, and the former Soviet Union. It lost its independence in the 14th century. As a crossing point of East and West, Armenia has at different times been invaded, with sometimes ruinous consequences, by Persians, Mongols, Byzantines, Russians, and others. By 1915, it was part of the dangerously fragmenting Turkish Ottoman Empire. The then Ottoman government, fearing their Armenian subjects would use the war to foment the goal of national independence, gave orders to deport many Armenians from their homes. Mrs. Gulasarian was one. The journey turned into an orgy of rape and killing of unarmed women and children by soldiers. Harat Chilingirian, an Armenian researcher at London University, says her story is one of many.
There are estimates that 800,000 to 1.2 million Armenians were massacred or deported to the deserts of Syria. In fact, this event remains to be a very big open wound in the life of Armenians today, simply because it has not been acknowledged for what it was, the attempt to annihilate a whole population in the Ottoman Empire.
In fact, what Armenians regard as genocide. Dr. Salahi Sonyel, a researcher and author of several publications on this period, voices the view still passionately argued by the Turkish government.
According to our calculations, about 300,000 to 400,000 Armenians lost their lives for all kinds of reasons: for war conditions, pestilences, illnesses, hunger, starvation. And also there was a civil war because the Armenian militants took the side of the Antant powers. That was the group opposing the Ottoman Empire, which belonged to the Central Powers. And there were killings, mutual killings, all over Turkey, particularly in the eastern provinces of Turkey, where Russia was invading the country with the help of the Armenians. And I have yet to come across any documents incriminating the Ottoman government that it carried out deliberately a genocide against the Armenians.
Yet historical evidence has persuaded the Italian, French, and European parliaments, though not the American House of Representatives, that genocide did take place in 1915. Armenians share not only their suffering, but their church, the one national institution that survived all. It's provided a sacred canopy under which past, present, and future have been woven together by a vision that's transcended passing powers and fashions. Harat Chilingirian.
In the absence of Armenian statehood, the church has played a sort of surrogate state for the Armenian people. And this has been sometimes assigned to the church by the ruling empires. For instance, during the Arab domination of Armenia, because of differences of religion, Islam versus Christianity, the Armenians were considered as primarily a religious community rather than a political community. For example, the head of the Armenian church, the Catholicos, played the role of the leader of the Armenians vis-à-vis the Muslim rulers of Armenia at the time.
Today, new challenges have arisen. The earthquake of 1989 killed some 25,000 people. The war with Azerbaijan recovered some ancient former Armenian territory in Nagorno-Karabakh, but at huge cost. Armenia this year celebrates its 10th year of independence, but the economy is chaotic, and some estimates suggest that up to a third of the population has emigrated since independence. But come what may, the national church is still there.
Most Armenians view their church, in fact, as their religion, as a fusion of beliefs, language, land, and history, the source of affirmation and validation of Armenian collective identity, and that's regardless of one's personal views. In fact, perhaps ironically, even Armenian atheists respect and give a lot of accolades to the church. Many of them are baptized as a way of ritual affirmation of their Armenianness.
So how, in this unique mix of Christianity, culture, patriotism, and atheism, is the church these days communicating the gospel? The current Catholicos, His Holiness Karakene II.
We have to educate enough clergy, and we brought up the number of the students from 30 to 300. To educate the people in Christian life, we had to prepare also religion teachers. Our main work will be to organize the community life so that our activities bring the results that we wish to see.
In the British Library with Dr. Rage Nassessian, the curator of this exhibition of Armenian art. Dr. Nassessian, one of the things that so fascinates me about Armenia is that it is a meeting point of East and West, and there's a very fine ceramic before us here, which I think in a way illustrates that. It's an oil lamp which would have been used for personal use. It's a ceramic which is in blue and white, but one of the very pretty things about it is that it is decorated with six pointed stars all the way around, through which the light must have glowed. And the sheer prettiness reminds me of Ottoman and Islamic art.
Yes.
But on the handle is what looks like an image of the face of Christ, perhaps?
It's an angel.
An angel.
Yes. The faces on the holders of the lamps are usually faces of angels, which are actually copying Armenian manuscript imagery.
To me, it's so interesting that even in an object of personal use like this, the religious imagery will be there as well.
Yes. Very little secular art exists in Armenia. Most of the imagery is either from the Bible or from the history of the Armenian church.
One of the things about this exhibition is that it reminds you of the Armenian communities in many parts of the world. There's a section about the Armenians in the Holy Land who arrived, many on pilgrimage, and remained in Jerusalem, establishing an Armenian quarter in the Old City, which still exists today. Dr. Nassessian, here is what looks like an official edict from one of the 18th century sultans of the Ottoman Empire, who of course in those days ruled that part of the world, and indeed Armenia, giving permission to the Patriarchate in Jerusalem, that means the church authorities, to renovate and rebuild the cathedral.
A fabulous edict with a large floral pattern, very typical Islamic headpiece.
And of course that cathedral is still at the center of the Armenian quarter in Jerusalem today. Patricia Golan has been visiting this Armenian monastery, or convent as it's called by local residents. It's a kind of walled world within a walled city.
Every afternoon, a priest rhythmically pounds a wooden block outside the doors of St. James Cathedral to announce Vespers. The practice dates from when the Ottoman Turks ruled the Holy Land and wouldn't allow the Armenians to ring church bells.
We are standing on the roof of the building which is next to St. James Cathedral, but in front of us we have a 5th century chapel, which is the second floor of the tomb of St. James.
George Hintlian is the resident historian here. He guides me around the labyrinth of cobblestone paths and up and down stone staircases inside the monastery compound. It houses the Armenian Patriarchate, library, museum, school, seminary, countless courtyards, and the living quarters for the clergy and families. Pointing to laundry hanging on lines on the roof, George Hintlian explains that the families living in the compound are descendants of refugees from what the Armenians say was a genocide when in 1915 the Ottomans forced Armenians from their homes in what is now eastern Turkey.
We have two segments of the Armenian population in Jerusalem. We have native Armenians who have been here for hundreds of years, if not for a millennium at least. But my generation is the first generation born in Jerusalem. So any Armenian family living within the monastery is actually from the second wave of immigration.
There are today around 2,500 Armenians living in Jerusalem, and a few thousand living in Jaffa, Haifa, and Nazareth in Israel. School children on a break outside the Armenian school, the first in Jerusalem in 1869 to become coeducational. Most Armenian children in the city study here. They have little contact with Arab or Jewish youth. Poet and playwright Anush Nakashian teaches secondary school pupils. She lives with her mother and teenage son in one of the larger apartments inside the compound. She says that what makes the Jerusalem Armenian community different from other diaspora communities is the centrality of church, school, and language.
Here, they all speak Armenian. They even fight in Armenian. They curse in Armenian, you see. And it's different here. The church is here. They're playing. Suddenly they want to go to the church, you know, and just to be there for 10 minutes. They pray and they come out.
Perhaps to keep troubles and the rest of Jerusalem locked out, a strict curfew is imposed on the compound. The massive iron door is shut from 10 p.m. until the early morning. Anush Nakashian admits this is not an easy arrangement for her.
I was 17 when I left home, you know. I went to Armenia to study. So after Armenia, after England, then I was in France and Swiss and here and there, coming back to Jerusalem. Not only the walls, but the walls inside too. It's not easy. But we're used to this in a way, you see. And you feel very safe inside.
In a small factory just across the road from the Armenian compound, Harut Sandruni produces fine quality traditional Armenian ceramics using techniques passed down from generation to generation.
We are trying to revive the colors and the motifs that were used ever since, what, the 14th century or even before, until the 10th century. Most of our creations are inspired from the old tradition. Okay, here are some pieces that have been decorated. They are sitting on the kiln here to dry.
In spite of the current difficult economic situation, Harut Sandruni says he prefers living in Jerusalem, despite the lure of North America, where he has family. But in such a small community where people rarely intermarry, how do young people find brides? Harut Sandruni explains that while in the past they used to go to Lebanon and Syria, today many find partners in Armenia, now that it is independent and open.
The Armenian community always managed and found the brides or found bridegrooms for the daughters. It's harder than finding them right next door, but it is possible, especially with the internet these days.
Throughout their long history in the Holy Land, the Armenians have always been loyal citizens of the government of the day. and living under Israeli authority is no exception. The Israeli-Palestinian conflict impacts all Christian communities here. The Israeli bureaucracy considers Jerusalem Armenians Palestinian, which means endless delays in getting documents and hassles at the airport. But despite the many difficulties, Armenians are determined to stay in Jerusalem and keep alive a diaspora community which is almost as old as Armenian Christianity itself.
Patricia Golan reporting from the ancient enclosed Armenian community in Jerusalem. We've heard much in this program about the 1700 years of Armenian and Christian history, but I'm now joined by three guests to discuss the future. Dr. Marina Kirchin is an Armenian sociologist. Professor Coral Goyman is a political scientist from Turkey and formerly the deputy mayor of Turkey's capital, Ankara. And Dr. Razmik Panossian is a Lebanese Armenian, also a political scientist. He's currently teaching at London University. Enclosed isolation is not an option for independent Armenia. It has neighbours and it has to live with them. Professor Goyman, there's so often a gulf between Turks and Armenians. What, in your view, would help narrow this gulf to help both countries look together to the future rather than to the past?
First of all, no person, Armenian or Turk, in his right mind would deny that several tragic events took place. Of course, it's a sensitive issue, and it becomes even more sensitive when we take into consideration that there isn't sufficient data which is reliable. And also, for many people who were not alive when such events took place, in a sense, it seems distant, and nationalism takes over, and this is certainly not a very good foundation to discuss how to improve relations in the future.
So you mean on both sides nationalism takes over?
Yes, definitely.
So what would you like to see happen to help change that atmosphere of conflict?
Both nations and their leaders should look to the future rather than the past. Armenia is a landlocked country. Armenia desperately needs access through air corridors and access to the sea. Armenia definitely needs to put a conflict with Azerbaijan and other neighbors. And this should be the starting point of any future cooperation. And at the same time, an independent commission can be arranged to look into historical facts.
Dr. Kirchin, is this possible?
I think it's not fair approach. It's very painful and unfair speaking about pain and suffering on both sides. And it's not helpful at all to bridge relations. I do agree that more research needs to be done. And I do agree that this research needs to be done with both sides together. For that, all archives need to be open.
Dr. Panossian, would you agree with some people who feel that sometimes the Armenians in the West have a rather romantic notion of Armenia, which is slightly removed from the everyday reality of life in the Caucasus as it is lived now?
Yes, certainly there is an element of romanticization of Armenia. There is an element of romanticization of the historic homelands of the Armenian provinces in what used to be the Ottoman Empire. Professor Goyman is correct in saying that nationalism is Janus faced. That is, one side of it looks to the past and another side of it looks to the future. And Armenians in the diaspora are, if you want to call it burdened with this, or if you want to call it, they are living this very tension. And they're looking at Armenia in a different sort of perspective that perhaps Armenians in Armenia are looking at their country.
Armenians in Armenia, they deal with today's problem and they really look in the future. The issue of genocide is more an issue being fair and apologies expected. But no, it's not deeply embedded now in Armenian identity in Armenia.
So it's more deeply embedded in, say, America?
I believe, yes.
Professor Goyman, what's your reaction to that?
There is, I think, ground for improvement of relations. The pivotal point from a Turkish point of view is not the allegations with regards to the past, but I think the Turkish foreign policy, and I'm speaking as an independent observer, is much more linked in today's world to the conflict between Azerbaijan and Armenia. And if and when some meaningful progress is made in this direction, and during the past few weeks there was considerable progress on that issue when both countries joined the Council of Europe, I'm sure that meaningful gestures would follow from Turkey.
You yourself have seen the refugee camps in Azerbaijan.
Yes.
And Armenian church leaders, I think, have had some contact with Islamic leaders in Azerbaijan. But what more could the Armenian church do to help improve things there?
Well, actually, in the past few years in Turkey, the representatives of different religious and ethnic groups came together on several humanitarian missions. This is just a personal view, but a similar humanitarian mission and cooperation could be facilitated jointly both for the Azeri Turk refugees and also the Armenian refugees.
In this program, we've been talking about the impact of the church and its relationship with the nation. But Dr. Panossian, how would you assess the relevance of the church now?
Well, it depends what you mean by relevance. Is it relevant in the daily lives of the people? Not really. By definition, Armenians are Christian. One cannot be Muslim and be Armenian. It's a very much ethnic, religious-based identity.
Still,
yes. But then when it comes to daily practices, when it comes to going to church, when it comes to seeing the world from a Christian perspective, I don't see that all that deep in Armenia.
The situation in Turkey is slightly different in the sense that religion is definitely part of the identity, but there are Jewish Turks and there are Armenian Turks and Christian Turks. And recently there has been quite a lot of visits between Armenia and Turkey. For instance, hundreds of Armenians will be visiting historical sites in Turkey to commemorate the 1700th anniversary of the Armenian Church's foundation. And on the occasion, Turkish and Armenian universities have offered various exchange programs. So these are definitely encouraging signs and developments.
Professor Coral Goyman, thank you. And warm thanks too to Dr. Marina Kirkchen and Dr. Razmik Panossian. And there we come to the end of our special edition of Focus on Faith. Let me leave you with music from the Mother Cathedral of Armenians at Holy Etchmiadzin in Armenia.
Focus on Faith was presented by Rosemary Harthill and produced by Michael Workman. The editor is Simon Coates.
This is the BBC in London. In a moment, 60 minutes of news and comment with NewsHour, BBC World Service, bringing you news 24 hours a day. It's 21 hours GMT.